This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Back home! I've been on the road a lot lately. Back here in Portland, Oregon. Broadcasting live from Los Angeles to New York, from San Francisco to Pittsburgh and all places in between. Pat Buchanan on the line with us. His new book, Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. Pat Buchanan, welcome back to the program.
Morning, Tom. Or good afternoon. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. I hope all is well with you, sir.
It's doing fine, thank you.
You're a lot to talk about in your book, Pat, and much like your previous book, which went after Bush on the Iraq War, which, in fact, had it not been for the last chapter, which I think just kind of was gratuitously sucking up to Republicans, no offense. I almost made it a BuzzFlash Book of the Month. We actually debated it with, which is this very liberal progressive website, you know, debated it with Mark, who runs that site, because you were so spot on in nailing the war in Iraq. And here again, in many areas, you're spot on in nailing these things. Other areas, you know, I think probably we can have some disagreements. But let's start out with the basic premise of the book, this Day of Reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
Go for it.
Well, I think what is happening in America is, as I say, on the positive side, America retains greater recuperative powers than any other nation in history, and we're still the first nation on earth far and away, and we can deal with these crises. But what I am saying is that coming up the road is a series of crises what looks like a perfect storm. I mean, last week we found out that 6 million illegal aliens made it into the country on Bush's watch, and 6 million Bush himself says he stopped. That is a gigantic invasion. And these folks are coming into this country at a time when the melting pot is not only broken, cracked, but it's rejected by multiculturalists sort of as an instrument of cultural genocide against indigenous peoples. And so you got to, that's one of the great problems of balkanization and breakup that we face down the road. But at the same time, you got the dollar sinking like a stone. You got 5 straight world record trade deficits. You got an army the chief of staff says is breaking over Afghanistan and Iraq. You're committed to fight on behalf of some 50 to 60 countries around the world, constantly adding them. And you got a Social Security Medicare crisis. And all of these things are coming at us at once. And I don't see an awareness of the gravity of the situation we confront. But the main danger for me, the one that really could end us, as Lincoln said, if we're going to die, it's going to be by suicide, is sort of the decomposition or the deconstruction of the country. Its breakup and its balkanization into its component parts of ethnic groups and racial groups. In other words, we used to be out of many one. And now it seems out of one that we're becoming many again.
Pat, you know, respectfully, we've never been out of many one. There is a very famous book that came out back 15 years ago or so called The Seven Nations of America. I'm sure you remember it.
Yeah.
You know, where this guy traveled around
and
he said,
nations.
You know, or nine nations. Yeah, whatever. He said, you know, the Southwest is really Tex-Mex. The Midwest he called the Rust Belt. The Northeast was something else. Florida he had a different name for. There have always been major cultural differences. Differences in the way we speak English, differences in the way we eat, differences in the way we vote politically.
Sure, those are not the serious things I'm talking about. Look, in 1960, we were a nation probably 90% European, 10% African-American, but we were all in part of the same national culture. And in terms of religion, we're probably 90-95% Christian, and you got agnostics and 4-5% Jewish folks and things like that. And the Jewish folks were mainly their parents or ancestors were from Europe. So you had a cohesive national country. Then you went through the cultural war of the 1960s that has continued and endured, which divides us along those lines.
Along what lines?
Well, among the lines of a cultural war. I mean, look, when you got a one half of the country thinks we've murdered 45 million babies in the womb, and the other thinks you know, the right to choose is one of the great liberators of women. You got a cultural war.
But how is that different, Pat, than in the 1960s with the passage of civil rights legislation? I mean, you said, you know, that 10% of African Americans were in it with all the white folks, and I have a feeling that a lot of them would say, excuse me, I beg to differ. We were very much on the outside looking in.
But you were on your outside, certainly economically.
Women were not even brought into this into the mainstream of America until 1920, and arguably still aren't.
Well, wait a minute, but that's the point is, the United States has never been more united than it was. I think, in my judgment, where the melting pot has succeeded in assimilating almost all of the folks who had come from Europe, and they stopped coming around the 1920s by 1960. And now you've got the breakdown, not only the cultural war and divisions, you've even got the Christian churches splitting as well, and you've got the huge masses of immigrants, folks from third world countries predominantly, who used to be roughly 18 million, mostly African Americans, when we really went to work on the problem of civil rights. But now you got 100 million. At the same time, you've got no melting pot working at all.
Well, but, you know, we had the melting pot in the late 19th century, the early 20th century. You had these waves of Italians,
for example,
your ancestors.
But what made them? What we had in common is that we all became Americans. We ceased being, you know, My ancestors are Scotch, Irish, and Protestants, and you take the gangs of New York, and they were fighting each other.
Yeah,
after
exactly.
100 years, they weren't anymore.
But if you look at the number of third-generation Latinos in the United States, 94% of them can carry on a conversation in English very well. Second-generation Latinos, 88% of them are fully conversant in English. It's only the first generation where you have 23% who are, and this includes illegal immigrants as well.
I think
this is the exact same thing you saw with the Italian immigration.
No, it is not. I mean, the Italians probably sent over three, I don't have the exact number, but the first groups are German, English, and Irish, and the Italians are far down the line, probably 3 million. We probably got 20 million Mexicans in the country.
But that was 3 million at a time when the population of the United States was fewer than 100 million. That was 3%.
Well, but the point is here, you have groups with regard to Mexico. And look, and clearly the American, let me say this, Tom, look, the American people have seen what you and I see. They've seen the numbers, they've seen what they consider the invasion. They are up in arms and outraged because they think they're losing their country, and they are correct. Now, you don't believe it, and you think the melting pot's going to work fine.
No, Pat, you mistake me. Excuse me.
It's not going to work at all.
Pat, with regard to immigration, I agree with you that a nation needs to define its immigration policies and needs to define them and enforce them very vigorously. I am strongly of the opinion that this is, however, more of an economic problem than a cultural problem. People have come into this country literally from day one and culturally assimilated. That, you know, is setting aside the whole, you know, Native Americans, you know, I mean, you and I, our ancestors were, I suppose, the original illegal aliens. But the fact of the matter is that I think that the average American is not so concerned about the fact that people coming in who speak Spanish, whose children will not speak Spanish but will speak English, because that's certainly the trend, and who do share, by and large, your value. Most of them are Catholics. You know, I don't think that that's what people are freaked out about. What they're freaked out about is that they're losing their pay, is that people are competing with them in the job market.
Look, what you see happening in the Southwest is basically Mexico is pushing its poor and unemployed into the United States. They remain patriotic Mexicans. You can tell that by the way they tear down the American flag when they're in the stadium of Los Angeles, and even in Mexico they chant Osama when they score points. These folks are loyal Mexicans. They came here to work. They want to keep their Spanish language. They want to keep their Spanish traditions. They want to keep their radio and TV station Spanish. They want to work in America, and they want to remain good, loyal Mexicans, and the Mexican government wants to keep them that way.
Sure, and if they don't intend to become Americans, then they shouldn't be here working, period.
Well,
and if they do intend to become Americans, then they should be applying for citizenship and trying to get a green card and doing it the correct way, period.
Right.
And so what you do is you put the employers in jail. If there's no job, people go back home.
Who's going to put the employers in jail?
Well, see, this is where I think probably you and I agree. I believe that the Bush administration should be doing that. I mean, it's not that hard to check a Social Security number.
Well, no, it's not at all hard, but this is one of my points. What's happening is the melting pot, as I see it, is broken down. We're becoming a bilingual nation, and we are becoming a multicultural nation, and people aren't told that you know, you've got to immerse yourself in American culture. Now, we don't even know what American cultural is now. So I think all the things that once begun that began and continued to unite us as a nation and a people are breaking down. The centrifugal forces are overcoming the centripetal forces. You look around the world and you see, Tom, Soviet Union broke up into 15 countries. Yugoslavia, as soon as it became free, broke up into 6, now 7. Czechoslovakia broke in half.
But those were all nations that had separate languages and separate national identities that went back hundreds of years.
Belgium is breaking in half, and Britain, the Scots want out of Britain. It is happening here.
But those are all countries that had separate identities before they were forced together. We're different than that.
Well,
we'll continue the conversation right after the break. We're talking with Pat Buchanan, his new book, Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. 16 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
United States, we're the ones who need it worst. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed and who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
You tell them, Merle Haggard, 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking with Pat Buchanan, his new book, Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. And Pat, welcome back to the program. I want to congratulate you on this book. As I said, there are some areas where we have some fairly strong disagreements, but you have done, and there's an awful lot where we absolutely agree, which frankly startles me. I loved your chapter where you compared the Bush Doctrine with the other various doctrines throughout history, the Monroe Doctrine, the Nixon Doctrine, the Eisenhower Doctrine, Carter, Reagan, etc. The big question, the thing that I'd like you to address if you could, you suggest that we close our overseas bases, you purge the neoconservative ideology, get out of Russia's face, to end trade deficits, reinstitute tariffs in the United States. Tariffs were the great builder. They built this nation from the founding of this country up until Reagan, Bush, Clinton in particular, and Bush. I'm wondering, you were in the Reagan administration in the 80s. Reagan in 86 did this huge amnesty, which I would say led in a large part to the explosion of immigrants that we have in this country. You and the Reagan administration championed the deregulation, although to give him credit, Jimmy Carter started it, but were champions of the deregulation that led to so much of this, and championed the most favored nation status and the early things that led to this one world state of the WTO and NAFTA and GATT and all this kind of stuff that makes the UN look like a, you know, like a children's game. You're taking positions now that are historically progressive positions. I mean, back to the late 19th century, historically populist and progressive positions. Where were you during the Reagan administration, and how did it go so wrong?
Well, now, I was a Friedmanite free trader. And if you read the book, you realize I had that exchange with Friedman. I was a Friedmanite free trader. I was also felt that illegal immigration, from what I saw back then, was not nearly the problem it was today. And it was in the campaign basically around 1989, 1990, when the Cold War ended. I initially said, look, you know, I'm a believer in the Cold War. The Soviet Empire is a malevolent empire. It's through all manner of hateful conduct. It's sought to deprive nations of liberty, and we're the main enemy, and we've got to fight this war. But when it was over, I said, look, if they've gotten up and gone home, and the Soviet Empire and Soviet Union are gone, let's us get up and go home and let the fat, sassy, rich Europeans undertake their own defense now because the Cold War is over. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I saw what the trade policies were doing to these working class folks and to these factories and these company towns and things. So I undertook to study in a book called The Great Betrayal, wrote a book arguing that the historic conservative position has been in favor of economic patriotism or economic nationalism to fund the government based on tariffs, have foreigners contribute to our government that way,
Arguably, Herbert Hoover was the last president to do that.
Pardon?
Arguably, Herbert Hoover was the last president to do that.
Hoover was the last president to do it, and I understood in the post-Cold War, in the immediate Cold War, why Ike would open the borders. You could, I mean, most important thing was the Cold War, and if you have to, in effect, sacrifice some of your economic dynamism and trade it off to let Europe and Japan take some of it in order for them to rise to their feet, I understand that as a temporary sacrifice. And with, as I say, with immigration, it's when I went out to California in 91, you talk to the people in Southern California, that's all they were talking about. And so you go to the border, you talk to Duncan Hunter, you understand this, and you say, look, our ideas, I think, were right, but now I think it's time for a change, like we've changed our immigration policy before, and now we need a timeout on immigration, and now we need to secure the border. And I said we need a 70 miles of fence, and everybody said that's a David Duke position, and now Hillary Rodham Clinton wants 800 miles of fence. So, I mean, we were ahead of our time back there, and what I'm saying is I see now the same thing. I mean, we've got the 5 straight world record trade deficit. Dollar's sinking like crazy.
I mean, these are the big issues, I think.
These
ultimately
are the big issues,
it comes
and nobody's addressing them. Kucinich understands them, but the Democrats got the wrong solution. Every time you ask them, they say we got to, you know, we got to bring up the standard of living in Guatemala or something. I say, look, I'm concerned about Guatemala, but I'm an American. And I'm concerned about the working people. I'm concerned about a rising standard of living here.
But, you know, that was the position that Franklin Roosevelt took.
Now, Roosevelt was a – Roosevelt, of course, he – Roosevelt was all over the lot.
Yeah, but, no, but, you know, Roosevelt's opposition to Hoover –
huh?
Roosevelt's opposition to Hoover in that regard was that he was going to rebuild America first, you know, to quote Merle Haggard.
Well,
and that's what you're saying
Hoover,
now. What's happened to the Democrats?
Roosevelt did what he had to do to get elected, talking about balanced budgets and all that stuff. That guy didn't have a conviction in his body. Now, look, and so, I mean, but here's the thing. I agree with the New Deal. I mean, because you got a national emergency, a national crisis. You try things. You have to.
Yeah.
I agree with that, even though it didn't work. You know, by 1937, we got 17% unemployment. The New Deal was a failure, I think, but, I mean, Roosevelt did try some things.
Yeah, well, it was
That's why he was reelected.
It was better than the 30% unemployment he had before that.
It was only 25%.
25. Well, still 17 is better than 25. Pat Buchanan, it's a good food for thought, this book. The Day of Reckoning, How Hubris, Ideology, and Greed Are Tearing America Apart. Patrick J. Buchanan, thanks, Pat, for being
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Even when your hope is gone, move along, just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is strong, move along, like I know you're
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, our website, AirAmerica.com for our blog. Angie in Santa Fe, California? No,
hi.
Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Angie.
Hi, yeah. Tom. I'm going to try to stay calm. Pat Buchanan brings up so much for me.
Yeah, there were so many. He would string together so many things I wanted to challenge him on I would have been interrupting him every three words. So I let a few things slide through there. But
he's a quintessential white recessive fear person because he's a white man who knows that his white maleness is going to be dying out unless he keeps it, you know, keeps the country in power, and
and that was where I first challenged him. I mean, you know, we've been through this with the Irish, we've been through this with the Norwegians.
Yeah.
When my grandfather came over here in 1917, the strong discrimination against the Norwegians, he would not allow my father to learn Norwegian, and which I think is a shame, but you know, that was the case. He lived in Chicago. I mean, we've been through this before in the United States. We've never been one culture as a country.
Yeah, but our national culture. We are, you know, ask a Native American. We are a culture of illegal immigrants.
There you go. Absolutely. But on the other hand, what Pat Buchanan does in this book, and it's one of the reasons why I'm not going to put it on the top of my liberals please read this book list, but I got to tell you, I spent a lot of time with this book, and that was my final question to him. He basically repudiates everything Reagan did.
Oh, exactly.
And it's like, what's going on here? You know, because you know, Reagan brought us all these disasters.
Right.
And you know, right on down the road. And Pat says, well, it's time for a new direction. Well,
but
I guess so.
he lamely tries to excuse it away, saying, well, it wasn't as big of a problem then, you know.
Yeah.
That was his big excuse. But he mentioned something about the New Deal being a failure. And
yeah.
Did you agree with that? I didn't.
No. I that's why I said, he said, you know, he only had unemployment at 17%. I said, that's a heck of a lot better than the 30% it was before. He says, like, it's only 25%.
Oh, it's only 25.
Still better than 25%.
Well,
I mean,
thank you.
You know.
Thank you for everything you do.
You're welcome, Angie. Bye-bye. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And no, the New Deal not only was not a failure, it saved capitalism from itself. And if we hadn't gotten into World War II, frankly, I think it would have been much more effective. The problem was that by going into World War II, we diverted an enormous amount of money that could have been used to build more bridges and more schools and more hospitals and more research facilities and more infrastructure in America and get us out of the Depression even faster, and instead turn that stuff into bombs that we dropped on Europe and Japan, never again to see that wealth. And so, you know, World War II slowed down the New Deal rather than the other way around. Doug in New Hampshire. Hey, Doug.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Hi. Something that Pat said struck me, and I've heard it many times from relatives, and I think we all have. It's that he said, we don't even know who we are anymore as Americans. And I think what that comes down to is all of his definitions in life are very visceral. They're very emotional. And he doesn't define Americans as people who believe in the Constitution and freedom. He defines Americans as people like him.
Well,
and he's
Doug. First of all, Pat's not here to defend himself.
And I don't just mean ethnically.
But I'll tell you, you know, I'm sorry. Pat Buchanan, you know, for all his faults, let's say for all the areas where he and I disagree, and there are many, as I said. I don't think that you can attack him for not believing in the Constitution.
No, I don't mean to say that. What I'm getting at is, on an emotional level, the definition of who we are is people like us, and
right.
It's sort of like always
Anglo-Saxon white guys.
Include new people. Well, maybe not just white people, but it's like people we know. And the more exposure he gets, he has to grudgingly accept, yeah, okay, they're Americans too, but he's always reluctant to say, yeah, they're Americans too. But Americans are defined as people who believe in the Constitution and, you know, pledge their patriotism.
Yeah, I'd like to keep this to the issues rather than you know, what Pat believes or who he is or something. You know, again, he's not here to defend himself. Paul in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Paul.
Hey, hi, Tom. Here's a great example of why illegal immigrants are needed here in the country. A coalition of farm workers recently made some landmark deals to boost the tomato pickers' wages a penny a pound, so that now they're getting a big $11 an hour for picking 200 buckets, 32-pound buckets. They get 45 cents per bucket a day, 200 buckets a day, and so they get $11 an hour. Now, who in this country, especially, I know this is going to sound racist, but especially spoiled white kids, are going to go pick tomatoes for $11 an hour, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, back in the 60s, as a teenager trying to save up money to go to college, I picked apples in northern Michigan, and I wasn't picking apples along with a lot of people from other countries. I was picking apples along with poor people from Michigan and a lot of college students, frankly, and up in White Cloud, Michigan. And the, you know, the bottom line is that if we're going to say this is, you know, this is like summer work or something like that, which it very much is in Michigan, then maybe there's and you can pay well enough that you can actually use that money to go to college, then maybe that's a reasonable thing. On the other hand, if this is year round work, as it is in California, this is a full time job. You should be able to support a family on it. It should not be subsistence living level wages. And if that causes the price of food to go up 5 or 10%, so be it. If it increases the cost of labor, if it increases wages, people will be able to afford that food.
Well, exactly. And what's sad about this is that now the Tomato Growers Exchange is trying to cancel the deals because they're calling it un-American, because a third party came in to make these deals. You know, and it's Burger King and McDonald's and Taco Bell that are joining the Tomato Growers Exchange to ruin these deals.
Yeah.
I mean,
You know, England used to have maximum, thank you, Paul, for the point. That's well made. England used to have maximum wage laws. They did not want a middle class to emerge. And this was one of the early battles in the late 1600s, early 1700s in the United States, is whether we should have maximum wage laws. It's illegal to pay a person over a certain amount because they wanted there to be a large class of the working poor who were politically disenfranchised, economically disempowered, and they would not rise up against the order. And instead, Thomas Paine, in his book The Rights of Man, back in the late 1780s, said, no, we should have minimum wage laws, not maximum wage laws. We should set a floor on wages, not a ceiling on wages. And as Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, said in the early 1900s, a person should be able to put their children through school. They should be able to know that they're careful and that they can survive during times of illness. They should be able to take a vacation. Just the straightforward bottom line stuff that makes it possible to say, yes, I'm the middle class. I mean, This is what the middle class is. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt on the living wage, this is so amazing. Here it is. This is Teddy Roosevelt. Keep in mind, this is the Republican Roosevelt.
We stand for a living wage.
Then he pointed out it's going to vary in different parts of the country, but it has some specific elements.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
A normal standard of living. Now, what does that mean, Teddy?
A standard high enough to make morality possible.
To make morality possible. You don't have to steal for your food.
To provide for education and recreation.
To provide for education. You can put your kids through school, through college, and you can take vacations.
To care for immature members of the family.
To care for immature members of the family. To pay for daycare.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness. This is Teddy Roosevelt in 1907. A living wage should be enough to pay for your health care.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age. In other words, Social Security or even better, a good solid pension. That's what we should have. And to say that anybody in this country should be working for less than that, anybody who's working full-time and try to support a family, is wrong. We cannot call ourselves moral if that's the situation we're going to stand for. Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say that, you know, I'm old enough to remember a time when, and, you know, I come from a working-class background. I'm college-educated now, so, you know, public school system hasn't been totally detrimental to me. But the thing is, I think a lot of your callers, like if you did come from a working class background, you grew up in neighborhoods where, you know, one of the breadwinners in the family, or perhaps just one parent, was working as a janitor. My dad was a paint salesman.
My dad worked in a tool and die shop.
Yeah,
raised
exactly.
Four kids.
Yeah, and I remember a lot of my, the kids in my neighborhood having an identical background to that, where our parents weren't college educated, but yet we had homes. Quite often, you know, we had a good working used car, and they could pay to take us on vacations. And, you know, I think the thing is people are forgetting that when they say these are jobs Americans don't do, they're forgetting that, yeah, at one time they were, but when they started to be sort of shifted out and, you know, immigrant labor brought in and then also outsourced, what happened is that those people didn't really have the voice to be noticed. And, you know, and many people ignored them. And I think that it's, I would hope more callers that kind of come from the same background might call in and add their experience where they remember, you know, a dad who maybe pushed a broom for a living or perhaps, you know, bagged groceries was able to support them.
Yeah.
And also I have another question. On these recordings you play,
yeah,
where do you get them on the net? I would love to record, download them.
You just have
them
to Google like crazy to find this stuff.
Okay, and is it free?
Yeah. Yeah, there's most of them. I mean, you know, if they require credit or there's some sort of payment or something, you know, we jump through those hoops. But
I would love to download them on a CD to play for my Republican family.
Yeah, most of this stuff is in the public domain, and you just have to Google like crazy to track.
Well, thank you, appreciate it.
Sean, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. 866-303-2270, 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. There are no jobs that Americans won't do for a decent wage. Remember the old Honeymooners show? Ralph Kramden worked in the sewers?
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Senator Larry Craig.
Hey there, what you doing out there? Here in this men's room, the stall could be 10 rooms for romance. I can hear somebody going. I can hear the dryer blowing.
You've got a flight soon, but I think I might soon have no pants. Oh, my sweet meat, tap three times on the pipe if you want me.
Enough. Larry Craig, we banish you into utter darkness. All these guys coming out now saying that they've been getting it on with Larry Craig, and given that it's coming out of the Idaho newspaper, this is not you know, the Advocate or Rolling Stone or something. I just don't see how much longer this guy's going to survive, and you know, which is kind of a shame. If he keeps his seat right up until Election Day, then the Republicans don't have an opportunity to put somebody in to replace him and get some traction. So who knows? That's a seat that might even go Democratic. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Sam in Vermont. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. Listen, this is it just me? I mean, kind of a two- or three-prong remark or question, but this also it follows the last caller that was just talking about outsourcing. But, you know, two years down the line, is it my imagination, or is this whole immigration thing about Mexicans going to be off the radar and very little to nothing having been done?
Actually, I think it's probably going to be the major issue of the 2008 election once it gets going, and then the Republicans are going to use it to beat the stuffing out of the Democrats.
But why is it? I mean, given the history, I mean, of Mexico to the United States, I mean, what do you see being done 2 years down the line?
Oh, I doubt much will be done at all. And frankly, the problem of illegal immigration into the United States dropping our wages is only the smallest part of it. The largest part of it is NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, and all these crazy trade agreements, which both Pat Buchanan and I are saying, and most progressives, actually, you know, David Sirota, one of the most articulate progressives out there, are saying, get rid of these trade agreements. These things are nuts. They're destroying the United States. We need to say enough already. Get rid of them. And with regard to the trade agreements, very straightforward. Steve in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Steve.
Thanks, Tom. I called about the Constitution, but that Larry Craig song reminded me, if I could repeat a joke from Stephanie Miller, you might even know the answer. How many Republicans does it take to screw in a light bulb?
I don't know. I fear to ask.
Republicans don't screw in light bulbs. They screw in men's rooms.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Anyway, you were talking about Teddy. You had a tape on there from Teddy Roosevelt the other a couple minutes ago. In 1919 and 1920, when the abolition and women's suffrage amendments were passed, was there a liberal conservative, as we'd call it, a breakdown on those votes? And was it the same on both amendments?
Yeah, the progressive, actually, with regard to abolition, I know virtually nothing. I've never
frankly
studied that.
Prohibition,
yeah. I've never really studied the history of prohibition. With regard to the women's suffrage, you know, the right of women to vote, that was something that was strongly argued by progressives for a long time.
Right.
And the reason why was because they believed that if women voted, they would vote in a progressive fashion. And history has demonstrated that to be the case, and it's a good thing. So, you know, frankly, the more of us who can vote, the more of us who can participate, the better democracy will function. The biggest problem we have right now is you know, this whole thing. Paul Weyrich, the Republican, for example.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome.
He's speaking in a church.
Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So, there you go. That's the Republican strategy. Jenna in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Jenna.
Hi, Tom. As a black American, I'm always surprised when I listen to Pat Buchanan at how much I actually agree with him on many topics.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy, isn't it?
Well, no, because what he's saying is true. And I think even more so now, when the middle class is adversely affected by a recession, let's say, you can believe that the black middle class is being devastated.
That's right.
And the last 30 years of immigration has in many ways helped our country. Of course, we need immigrants. But also it has helped diminish the middle class, and the black middle class is being, I think, affected in so many adverse ways.
Yes.
And this idea that there are Americans, black Americans, white Americans, who just simply refuse to do certain jobs, I think one of your callers just really hit the nail on the head. 30 years ago, if you worked in the meatpacking industry, for instance, you were in one of the highest paid blue collar jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And now those numbers have been completely reversed. And it has nothing to do with the poor people in other countries who want to get to this country. It has to do with, as you said many times, employers. And I think there should be strict sanctions and maybe even jail time for some of these employers.
Yeah. Well said. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer problem in this country. Jenna, thank you very much for the
thank
call
you.
And for your thoughtful comment. Dan and or Don in New York. Hey, Don.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on something here. I just turned on and caught like a couple minutes of Pat Buchanan, and then I heard some of the callers afterwards. And I've heard this one woman said something that I've heard many, many times on, you know, Air America and a lot of radio stations and a lot of people say, and it almost seems like it's sort of like the accepted mindset that we're all supposed to have if we're Democrats, progressive, whatever. And I just can't really buy into this thing, this notion that we're all a nation of illegal immigrants, okay? My grandfather was not an illegal immigrant when he came over in 1910 and went through Ellis Island.
Yeah, neither was mine in 1917 on my father's side. Although I would say that my grandfather, my great-great-great-great-great-great-great on my mother's side, who came to the United States in the mid-1600s, was probably very much an illegal immigrant, and as much as the Native Americans didn't want him here.
Well, yeah, but that's you know.
And that's the point that I think people make.
Yeah, but
say we're
if
all
you follow that line of thinking, the only two legal people in the whole world practically were Adam and Eve, you know, based on how the world has developed over the years. So I think that's really kind of a stretch. And she's not saying it to... She's saying it to make a larger picture, that we should just open the borders, you know, let everybody in.
Yeah, if she's saying that,
like
Don, then I strongly disagree with her, and we'll end it there.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Interesting post over by Devil's Tower over on the Daily Kos. The question for this hour, by the way, should we make voting mandatory? I'm going to get to that in just a half a second, but I thought this was fascinating. If you invested $10,000 in the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 2000, how would you be doing? After all, the whole thing about let's privatize Social Security is like, let's put it in the stock market. So we got 7 years here. Let's look at it. That $10,000 would have been worth a little less than $10,000, just a few dollars less in 2001. In 2002, it would have been worth $9,182. With inflation, it would have only been $9,079. By 2003, it would have been down to $7,500 in pre-9/11 dollars. In 2004, your $10,000 would have only been $9,495, inflation adjusted. 2005, it would have been down to $9,021. In 2006, it would have been down to $8,922. And today, even though in 2007, even though the Dow is at 11,700, you think, gee, I'm making money on that $10,000. When you adjusted for inflation, no, it's right back in the neighborhood of $10,000. So you basically, you might have made it $200-$300 over the seven-year period. Don't think most people would consider that a good return on investment. Make voting mandatory. Larry Flint, of all people, well, not of all people, actually, Hustler, you know, the amazing thing to me, I told you I had lunch last week with Bruce David, the editor over at Hustler, and he gave me a copy of the current issue, the February issue. And here's an article by Robert Scheer, an article by Nat Hentoff. Cindy Sheehan drops by. I mean, this has become, in addition to being a skin magazine, a men's magazine, it's also become a progressive magazine. It has been for a long time, actually. And Larry had an interesting editorial here. He says, the Republicans will never agree to this, of course. Their very survival is based on suppressing the vote. But he say, make voting mandatory. He said, they know the majority of Americans would never support the GOP's self-serving agenda, tax cuts for the rich, corporate welfare, war for oil, etc. On the other hand, a staggering 95% of Australia's registered voters turn out on Election Day. Why? Those who fail to cast a ballot are fined. Some Americans may find such penalty harsh, but consider this. Paying taxes is mandatory as it should be. We need to collect money to help keep our nation great. Voting is no less important with regard to maintaining our form of government. Is punishing citizens who don't respect our democratic process any different from punishing those who cheat on their taxes? How about making voting mandatory? That's interesting. In Australia, it is mandatory, and 95% of registered voters actually vote. Now, what happens if you don't vote? You receive an article by Eric Weiner in Slate magazine. Back in October 2004, he says, you'll receive a fairly polite form letter. At this point, you can settle the matter by paying a $15 fine or offering any number of excuses, including illness, no note from your doctor required, travel, religious objections, or just plain forgetfulness. For most people, the matter ends there. 95% of the people who don't show up, which is about a half million registered voters every election, offer a valid excuse and the matter ends there. 5% pay a fine. So it's really no big deal, and yet everybody votes. John Dean, back in 2003, over in Find Law, writing, is it time to consider mandatory voting laws? He said, out of the 172 countries for which figures are available, our country ranks 139th in the percentage, in the turnout, the percentage of people who could legally vote who actually do vote. 139 out of 172. Zambia does better than we do. There are roughly 186 million people who would be eligible to vote in the United States. 130 million of them, more or less, are registered to vote. That's about 70%. And of them, 111 million voted in the last presidential election. So at 186, we have 111 million people who actually bother to show up to vote. 33 countries, John Dean notes, all of them democracies, have mandatory voting laws like Australia does. Why did this come about? Well, in 1922, Australia had a turnout of 58%. Keep in mind, ours is 60%. This totally freaked them out. They said, this is awful. 58% of people are voting. This isn't a democracy. So they passed a law saying, if you don't vote, you get a $15 fine. 1924. Now, in 1924, $15 was actually a fair amount of money. That might have been like $100 in today's money. And now, but even though it's still $15, Australians vote. Americans don't. Now, whenever you talk about this, the conservatives get all hysterical. They talk about this 1896 case, Kansas City versus Whipple, in the Supreme Court of Missouri, where there was this $2.50 poll tax if you didn't vote. And the Missouri Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional. But the fact of the matter is, this isn't the U.S. Supreme Court. This was the Missouri Supreme Court, number one. And number two, it's never been before the U.S. Supreme Court. And number two, there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that would prevent mandatory voting laws. Period. This has never been before the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, there were mandatory voting laws in Georgia, Virginia, and North Dakota back in the 1700s. For example, as Norman Ornstein points out in an op-ed in the New York Times, Vote or Else, back in August of last year, he said, even with all the attention devoted to Connecticut's Democratic primary, which Ned Lamont upset Senator Joseph Lieberman, turnout was an anemic 43%. It was arguably the most important race in the nation, and not even half of registered Democrats bothered to vote. This group, in turn, made up barely 15% of the voting age population of the state. Do you get it how different America would be if the vast majority of Americans came out to vote? Now, the Republicans definitely do not want this to happen. They don't want compulsory voting. Because, you know, as I shared with you before, and it's worth listening to again, it's just a quickie. Paul Weyrich, the guy who calls himself the author of the Reagan Revolution, the Republican direct mail strategist back in the 80s, even worked on the George W. Bush campaigns. Paul Weyrich, one of the leading architects of the Republican takeover of America over the last 30 years, talking about voting.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down. And so you wonder why in Ohio in the 2004 presidential election, people in African-American communities received a letter which looked like an official letter on Secretary of State letterhead. Given that Ken Blackwell was the Secretary of State, maybe, in any case, African-Americans received this letter on Secretary of State letterhead saying that because turnout was going to be so heavy for the 2004 election, instead of voting in the precinct where you're normally registered to vote, you have to go to a different precinct in another part of town. In some cases, African-Americans received a letter saying that because the turnout was going to be so heavy that Democrats were going to vote on Wednesday, Republicans were going to vote on Tuesday. And some people actually showed up at the polls on Wednesday. The people who were told that they had to go to a different precinct, and we're talking tens, well, nobody knows for sure, but at least tens of thousands of people. They go to the wrong precinct. They stand in line for 6 or 7 hours. And much of this misdirecting people to precincts accounted for some of these long lines. And then they get up to the front of the line and they're told, I'm sorry, you're not on the list for this precinct. You can't vote here. Well, where am I on the list? I don't know. But you can't vote here. We don't have your name. And then on top of that, of course, you had the whole caging thing that Karl Rove's assistant was in charge of, where they send out letters to people that say, enclosed is a postcard, please return this postcard to verify that you're a registered voter, otherwise we'll take your name off the rolls. Only it doesn't quite say it that cleanly, and if the postcard doesn't come back, then they challenge African Americans at the polls. Conservatives want fewer Americans to vote. Frankly, I think the best response to this is to say, everybody must vote, just like you must pay taxes. If you don't, $15 fine. 16 minutes past the hour.
To the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, and time for, believe it or not, a Larry Craig alert.
Naughty boy, bad boy, a naughty boy, a nasty, bad, naughty boy.
Yes, this best nasty, bad, naughty boy is on his way to Bali. Larry Craig on a plane to Bali, where the Kyoto Treaty is, first of all, the only two major countries not to sign are us and Australia. Australia just threw out John Howard, and the new guy in there, Kevin Rudd, says he's going to sign the new one. So it's just us. So who are we sending to Bali to represent us? Larry Craig. He's the Republican representative from the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, which is led by chief global warming denier James Inhofe, the Republican from Oklahoma, whose guy, Mark Morano, is a regular on this program, telling us how they ain't no such thing. Larry Craig, who has blasted Barbara Boxer. He says Senator Boxer will be welcomed as a liberator, and Al Gore will probably receive another award. There's nothing but hot air in Bali. In 1998, he said the Kyoto Protocol was, quote, an unnecessary response to an exaggerated threat. The vice president himself, that would be Al Gore, is caught up in making this. And he adds, on his own website, over at craig.senate.gov, Scientists are not certain how much man contributes to climate variability compared to nature. True. They don't know if it's like 70% or 71% or 80%. But it's a chunk! So, our Larry Craig alert for that.
Naughty boy. Bad boy. A naughty boy. A nasty, bad, naughty boy.
Now, see, if everybody had to vote, Larry Craig never would have gotten into office. It's just that simple. The vast majority of Republicans would not be in office because they don't represent the interests of most Americans. Chris in Southern Illinois. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I have a quick question and a comment. First, I listen to you on Sirius LA Radio, and they only cover an hour of your show.
Yeah, they play the other 2 hours a little later on in the day.
Oh, well, I do not know how the radio industry works, but is there anything I could do to lobby to try to get your full show on there all at once?
No, and that's something you need to take up with Sirius, and I can't talk about it on the air, Chris. I just don't get into programming stuff. What's your topic?
My
question?
Comment versus mandatory voting, I am totally for it. I believe if we had the voter turnout like you said Australia does, where 90% of the people were showing up, I believe that would then motivate the congressmen and senators to realize that they're there to work for the people and not there to work for their party or the people who donate millions of dollars to corporations who sponsor them.
Yeah.
So I'm totally for mandatory voting.
How do you think we, you know, in Australia it's a $15 fine, and if you just say, hey, I was busy, that's fine. You get out of it. 95% of the people give an excuse and they don't have to pay the $15. Seems to work.
I think a penalty might hinder it a little bit and make a little bit more opposition to it. I think maybe go the other way and make a benefit for it. I can't think of any good benefit that would make people vote, but I think if $15
tax
credit down as a punishment as opposed to a benefit to vote.
Yeah, what if when you go to vote, you get a piece of paper from the voting folks that if you include it with your taxes, when you send it to the IRS, you get $15 off your taxes?
Yeah, I mean, I donate blood because they give me a cookie afterwards.
Yeah, see, the problem with paying people, though, to vote is that is an area where I think that, you know, we could say, hey, wait a minute, paying people to vote, not a good thing. But I don't know. We'll kick it around. Chris, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Don in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Hey, Don.
Fining isn't a good thing either, Tom.
Say that again?
Fining people vote isn't a good thing either. I'd rather have Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the voting days. People have time to get off from work on Friday if they had to, but this business of one-day voting is ridiculous in a country this size.
Well, that's a good point. And also, same-day registration. We have 8 or 9 states now where you can vote. You can register to vote on the day that you vote. And we should have national same-day registration, and we should make it a holiday. You know, say Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and make the Friday a holiday. Friday is, you know, the only problem is that's going to require a constitutional amendment because the Constitution specifies Tuesday as the voting day.
Well, we need a few constitutional amendments, and I know how long it takes to get them through.
I'm
pushing 80 years old.
You know, there's been over 19,000 amendments to the Constitution proposed, and we've got, you know, fewer than, what, 30, I think, altogether?
Yeah, but sometimes the urgency, it's just like the New Deal, and I was a kid then, but crisis brings about change, Tom, and we're, man, if you haven't, I wanted to say one thing, and this regresses a little bit from your topic, but I did have a comment on your topic. But you and Pat, I don't think I heard you talk about how the United States in the 1900s, when that first big wave of early Southern European immigration came, we were the fastest growing industrial power in the world. Mm. And we passed Britain in 1913. So today, we're sending the jobs away.
Yeah. Although, Don, you know, we are sending the jobs away because back in 1913, we had laws, we had tariffs that protected us that essentially said if you try to take this job over to some other country, when you manufacture that product and bring it back to the United States, you're going to have to pay a fairly stiff tax on it when you bring it back in. So people didn't offshore jobs. 27 minutes past the hour.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry. Cause I always wanted me one that was long and black.
One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in the lunchbox in my hand. Now getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You'll know it's me when I come through your town.
Yes. I'm gonna ride around. Well, here's the corrections. Yes, it was Ed Norton who worked in the sewers. Thank you to the folks who have let me know in the chat room and in email. Ralph Cramden was the character played by Jackie Gleason, who was the bus driver. Both of them good middle-class jobs. And, I guess in some areas, bus drivers still have good middle-class jobs. But Ed Norton worked in the sewers. There is no job that Americans won't do for a good union wage. There just isn't. And somebody had asked about where our songs are and where our clips are and all that kind of thing. Sue Nethercutt puts a lot of that stuff on the website over at tomhartman.org. You can check out our stack, and we're slowly integrating as much of that as we can, and ultimately, hopefully, all of it into tomhartman.com as we're rebuilding that website right now. So check out the website, and you can find the stack. Just a quick heads up here. The national intelligence estimate that was reportedly completed a year ago, but blocked by the White House, is now out. It says, and I quote, this is from the National Intelligence Estimate. I quote, we assess with moderate confidence Tehran had not restarted its nuclear weapons program as of mid-2007. We continue to assess with moderate to high confidence that Iran currently does not have a nuclear weapon. Tehran's decision to halt its nuclear weapons program suggests it is less determined to develop nuclear weapons than we have been judging since 2005. They also concluded with high confidence that in fall 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program. So Saddam stops building weapons of mass destruction and dismantles everything he has. We invade them. Tehran stops their nuclear weapons program in 2003. Is it repeating? 413 days, 10 hours, 16 minutes, 15 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. Not a moment too soon. 1-866-303-2270. How do we get more people to vote? Instant runoff voting would be a good one, too. Let's, as Australia and New Zealand have done, let's make it possible for multiple parties to participate. You'll draw in more people into the electoral process. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. If we were to have mandatory voting, I believe that concomitant with that should be the declaration of a national holiday in order for people to find it easier to vote, and also an effort to get to the infirm and the elderly and work with them and encourage them to register for absentee ballots.
I agree. And because the Constitution requires it be on a Tuesday, then we should simply make that Tuesday a holiday. And we can combine it with something. Make it George Washington's birthday Tuesday or something.
That sounds good.
We've already messed with his birthday once, so we could do it again. Bernice, thank you very much. Great to hear from you. Anita in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Anita.
Hi. I was just going to suggest something that was suggested to me the other day. With all the states fighting over who's going to be the first in the nation to vote, if each state if we determined the percentage of people who voted in each one of the states, that state that had the highest number, highest percentage voting, would be the first in the nation the next time, as a carrot to encourage people to vote.
Oh, that's interesting. So the state with the highest percentage of voting compliance, not the largest number of people who turn out and vote, because
exactly.
You know, California, New York would win that, but the
exactly.
largest percentage. So it could even be a little state like Delaware or Wyoming.
Exactly.
Then if the Democratic and Republican parties, of course they'd never agree to this, but maybe you could do it by. I don't know that you can mess with the party politics by law. I don't think you can. That would be considered an unlawful sticking the government, the nose of government into electoral politics. But what a cool idea. What a really great idea that whichever states that you set up the right of a state to determine what their date is for their primary. And some states may say, yeah, we don't want to do it. But most will, because, gee, there's all that money and all those candidates coming to town and all those hotel rooms and all that media buy and everything else. And just say, yeah, whatever state has the highest percentage of voters in the primary gets to be the first in the nation next time around. What a cool process. John in Rawlingsville, Colorado. Hey, John.
Mr. Hartman, good morning here. I wanted to give you kudos. Also, at the end of your show, you say, tag, you're it. Mm-hmm. Well, I finally did it. I've been jumping through hoops trying to... last year, I wanted to vote in the Democratic elections and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It took me 6 months to get my birth certificates from Michigan to get a proper ID because of this immigration thing. It took me 6 months just to do that so I could become legal to vote. And now that I'm legal to vote, I did vote. And this year I'm getting involved with the Democratic caucus or, you know,
That's
the
great.
Convention thing. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. I've got so many friends and people around here that I try to talk to and say, you got to get involved. You got to vote. You got to, you know, take some kind of grassroots stand, or you have to have an opinion about these things.
Right.
And it's like pulling teeth to get anybody to even bother with it, because you got to jump through so many hoops just to, you know, get a voter card or something.
Well,
like
that goes back to Paul Weyrich's Republican strategy, that they want to drive down the number of potential voters as dramatically and as rapidly as they can.
I agree. That's why it prompted me to call you. I've been listening to you. You've been educating me so darn much that I'm frankly afraid of this. I'm turning in my paperwork tomorrow because I was unaffiliated. Mm-hmm. Now I'm turning it in tomorrow so I can be in time for the caucus.
Right.
And I don't even know what the caucus is about. Right now I'm leaning toward Kucinich Edwards or Eric Kucinich. I don't even know how this is supposed to work.
Yeah.
So I'm jumping in
with both feet.
Uncharted waters, you
That's
know?
Great. That's great. Well, good on you, John. Congratulations and you know, thank you for your patriotism, for participating in our democracy. I salute you, and I'm moving along, but thanks for the call. Matt in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Matt.
Hey, great to be on. You stole my thunder a bit. I was going to call to say that usually, especially Americans don't like anything mandatory. They don't want to be told that they have to do anything. So
mm-hmm.
I think a tax receipt would get people out there, you know. I think
yeah.
$50.
You know, here's another one that might be less viewed as a bribe. You know how on your taxes you can check a little
a bribe, no.
I know, but that's how it would be, fought, and that's, you know, people would say, no, you can't pay people to vote. But you know how on your taxes where you can check the little box and say, in my name, put $5 into the presidential election fund,
mm-hmm.
and it won't cost you anything, by the way. And that becomes the federal matching dollars and that sort of thing. And actually, if all taxpayers check that box off, and the amount was raised up to, I think, like $10 per voter, we'd have enough money to fully fund all the elections, you know, all the presidential elections anyway, and congressional races and presidential years across the country at the full amount. Now, all corporate money would be out the window.
Okay.
That'd be a great idea. What if we said, if you vote, then you don't have to check that box on your taxes, but if you vote, then $15 will be given to to the presidential election fund or something. Well, I don't know.
I think, you know, if it came out of your taxes and people didn't have to pay it. Otherwise, I don't think they care enough, because if they cared enough, they would go and vote.
They would have voted in the first place.
And they don't
right
care
now.
Enough. And I think it would be interesting because a lot of people would go and just pull the lever for anybody.
Yeah.
And so then you'd have a situation where people were, like, voting for Howard Stern or Gary Coleman or whoever.
Well,
and
you know,
politicians would have to do something about it, and it would definitely make things much more serious, and they would be genuinely concerned about who was voting for who.
Yeah, in Australia, I think they call those people pin the tail on the donkey voters, and it is a noticeable percentage. It's like 1 or 2% of voters will just randomly pick somebody and brag about it and say, I don't want to get the $15 fine, and I don't want to have to fill out the paperwork, so I'll go in and vote, but I don't give a damn who I'm voting for. But it's such a small percentage.
If people aren't voting, I think it would be a lot more than 1 or 2%.
Well, but you get people in the habit of voting, and you're going to get them in the habit of paying attention. I really think that that's how it'll work. Jim in thanks for the call, Matt. Jim in San Jose, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you. I've got a couple of ideas. I've bebopped around the country a little bit, and I was in Denver, Colorado at the last elections last year, and I got shut out of the voting booth because the average wait time of the 5 different places I went to was well over 2.5 hours. So my first suggestion is we've got to make it easier for people to vote.
Yeah.
Why not use resources that we already have, like maybe on Tuesdays, if it has to be mandatory Tuesdays, all the D&Ds across the country take voters. I don't know.
Here in Oregon, we vote by mail. The entire state, we vote by mail. You get a ballot about a month and a half before the election. You've got 6 weeks to fill it out, or however long the time is. I frankly don't know. But I've voted in 2 elections here in this state in the 2.5 years I've lived here.
That's a good idea, too.
Yeah, it works just fine. It works very well. And, our Secretary of State's a very good guy, and the process is quite transparent, and there's always a paper trail. Because you've got the actual physical ballots. As I said, it works quite well. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. How do we get more people to vote? A better country and another 413 days, 10 hours, 2 minutes, and 49 seconds when George W. Bush voluntarily steps down, assuming that he's not impeached between now and then. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Yes, the president did something unusual today. He did a couple of things. One thing was he made remarks in the Rose Garden, which, of course, frees the ass off the press corps, who, you have to go out and wait for him. So they had to get out there probably about 9:40, 9:35 and wait for him to come out. He, of course, just gets to come out, make the remarks, and leave, so he doesn't get cold.
This is like punishment or just the way it's always been?
It's just the way it's always been, but it's one of those things. It is December. Why are you making remarks in the Rose Garden when you could make remarks in the East Room, for example?
Mm-hmm.
Make remarks anywhere you like. It's your house. You could do whatever the heck you like, but
right.
That's what he chose to do. And then, shortly after that, we got an announcement by email that he's having a press conference tomorrow morning at 10:10. Well, that's fine. He can have a press conference anytime he likes. But what's unusual about this is that normally the way this White House works is it makes an announcement about a press conference about 2 or 3 hours ahead of the press conference. It never gives us any notice at all. It's very unusual to give us a day's notice for a press conference. Then we were told that today's briefing had been moved back an hour, so we thought, fine. And then we got a notice saying that the briefing had been cancelled and that Stephen Hadley, National Security Advisor, would hold an on-camera briefing at 3:15 this afternoon. So goodness knows what's going on at the White House today.
Hmm. Has any of this press stuff happened yet? I mean, do you know what the topic is or anything?
Don't know what the topic for Stephen Hadley's briefing is yet, no. I imagine that will be leaked during the course of the rest of the day, but I don't know what it is yet.
Interesting. The screaming headline right now on the New York Times electronic edition is that the national intelligence estimate, the new national intelligence estimate, saying that there are no weapons, there is no nuclear program going on in Iran, and there hasn't been since 1993, or excuse me, since 2003. That's when they abandoned their program. And
that will be this will be the topic of his briefing then.
You think so?
The National Intelligence Estimate. I would think so, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
That would make sense to me.
So he's going to what? Make fun of it?
I would not think he's going to do that exactly, but I would think he's going to put his own spin on it. But what the purpose of tomorrow's press conference after the statement today in the Rose Garden is, I don't know, except to pile more on the Congress after the extensive piling on that the president did today.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. You know, this, by the way, this national intelligence estimate apparently has been delayed by the White House for over a year.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Wow. So, well, I would imagine if they, the longer they can delay it, the more they would want to if there is information in it that they really do not want to see come out.
Yeah, yeah. Larry Craig on his way off to Bali for the conference on global warming.
Well, there are many things in Bali that you might want to see. It is certainly a tourist destination, is it not?
And I understand that they have not, unlike the Minneapolis airport, they have not dropped the walls on the men room stalls down to the floor level. So who knows? Maybe. I'm sorry. I shouldn't make Larry Craig jokes. It's
there are many leisure activities in Bali. I'm sure that he can find many ways to pass his time.
No doubt.
I'm sure he can. It is certainly being talked about in Washington today, I can
yeah.
tell you.
What's the deal with the White House blocking Patrick Fitzgerald from turning his own documents from his own research over to the House representative, over to Henry Waxman's committee?
There really hasn't been very much buzz on that, I have to tell you, so far.
Waxman today wrote a letter to McCasey asking him to allow Fitzgerald to share these documents about the leaking of Valerie Plame. And he says, and in his letter, he says, unfortunately, the White House has been blocking Mr. Fitzgerald from providing key documents to the committee. I mean, not only is that kind of horrifying in as much as that means that Fitzgerald is doing whatever the White House tells him, but it also kind of confirms the notion that Fitzgerald is no longer investigating the White House, you know, what George knew and when he knew it and all that kind of thing.
That's very, I hadn't heard this. This is new to me. This is very interesting. I had no idea that this was going on.
Yeah. What else is on your list of what's happening in Washington?
Well, the main thing is that Congress gets back into session today and has an enormous amount to do. The big priority really is one of the things that the president highlighted, the alternative minimum tax.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things that Congress is very much aware is going to be on the voters' minds, and that, you know, you've got 25 million middle-class Americans who don't want to pay an extra $2,000 in taxes. Congress looking to fix this one way or another because they know that whatever the merits of this are, this is going to look bad for them if they have constituents who are going to end up paying more in taxes. The other thing that is of great interest is that Paul Wolfowitz looks as though he's going to be back in the administration.
And with regard to weapons of mass destruction, if I recall correctly.
With regard to weapons of mass destruction playing some role in the State Department, it looks as though he is going to be taking a position as chairman of the International Security Advisory Board, which is regarded as, according to Michael Isikoff of Newsweek, as a prestigious State Department panel. This is according to two department sources. And it's an 18-member panel which does have access to highly classified intelligence and advises Condoleezza Rice on disarmament and nuclear proliferation and WMD issues.
Now, I was of the impression that Wolfie and Condi were not getting along all that well these days. What is there going to be some interesting dynamic coming out of this, or am I of the wrong impression?
Well, it seems as though they may be getting along better than people thought, or maybe whether she gets along well with him or not, she thinks that his expertise is something that she needs.
Or perhaps he's being forced on her by the Bushies.
Well, that's also a possibility, because the word around town has been for some time that she has limited power.
Yeah, yeah, that she's sort of secretary of state in name only, almost. Symbolically.
Yeah.
Interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always appreciate your reports. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Peter DeLorenzo on the United States of Toyota.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So how did Detroit get in so much trouble? I can tell you, I saw a lot of this up close and personal. I mentioned in the last, or I think it was in the first hour, we were talking with Pappy Cannon. My dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years in Lansing, Michigan. And probably 95% of the products that they made were for Oldsmobile, which was literally two blocks up the street, the Oldsmobile factory. I've seen the American car industry, and I've seen it collapse in my lifetime. Peter M. DeLorenzo is with us. He is the author of a new book, The United States of Toyota. Detroit squandered its legacy and enabled Toyota to become America's car company. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm just great, but I'll get better. Your website, by the way, autoextremist.com or unitedstatesoftoyota.com. In your book, you quote New York Times op-ed columnist Tom Friedman, one of the people that I love to kick around. He writes this column back in June of 2005 where he opens with a question, or he opens it up with a question. He says, so I have a question. If I'm rooting for General Motors to go bankrupt and be bought out by Toyota, does that make me a bad person?
Yeah.
Now, I would say, yes, Tom, you are. Tom Friedman, among others, I mean, he started this with his book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus, back in the day, and Clinton bought into this stuff, and certainly the Republicans have been buying into it, at least since Reagan and arguably since Nixon. How did the U.S. auto industry get so bad, or get in such a bad fix?
Well, it was a series of things, but generally you could attribute it to complacency, coupled with the fundamental belief that the sun would never set on the Detroit Empire, and then finally just ignoring the inroads that the competition were making to their strongholds in the market.
So the argument that it's the unions who are doing it, the argument that it's the CAFE standards that are doing it, it's the argument that the big three have higher legacy costs because they've got retirees, whereas the newer car companies in the market, you know, Toyota coming in, building new factories, they don't have to pay for pensions for guys who are retired. Those are not the major variables?
No, they are. But, Detroit isn't blameless. They contributed to their predicament. Those things you just mentioned are absolutely crucial to this whole picture. But, I'm not going to sit here and say Detroit wasn't culpable. But
I remember the early 70s. It was a rather startling time. As I recall, it was 72, 73. Louise was pregnant with our oldest so I'd have to go back and look, but it was right around then when the Arab oil embargo happened. We were living in Detroit at the time, and within 3 days, the store shelves were empty. There were long gas lines. People were being shot waiting in gas lines, the odd even days to buy gasoline and essentially gas rationing. And what followed on that was an explosion in demand for small, mostly Asian-made automobiles that were gas-efficient. And you would think somehow that Detroit would have figured out that something was going on in the years since then. I mean, that was 30 years ago.
Yeah, well, that was actually the beginning of Detroit's slide. We should talk about, maybe we can get to it at the end, but Detroit isn't where they were. Detroit is definitely on the comeback. But, yes, that was the beginning of Detroit's long slide, where they missed the market in a lot of ways with the right vehicles at the right time. They missed that. Their attention to detail and quality fell off. And they weren't even in the game for many years.
Yeah.
And during the course of all of that, they pretty much lost a generation of American car buyers, which is what the predicament they find themselves in today when they are in fact building many competitive and in some cases class leading vehicles, and they can't get the American consumers to give them the time of day.
Yeah. So to what extent, for example, if General Motors wants to sell a car to China, China imposes a 20% import tariff. If China wants to sell a car in the United States, there's a 2% import tariff. I don't know what the tariff situation is with regard to Japan, but back in the late 70s, I worked for a company that did business in Japan, and I went over there and I negotiated some deals to import things into the United States. And it was damn near impossible to still sell stuff into the Japanese market without a Japanese partner, without jumping through a million hoops. To what extent is our having said, okay, we're not going to protect our domestic industries anymore, that whole position, that so-called free trade position, have something to do with this?
Oh, that has been absolutely devastating. You're talking about, see, the different fundamental difference here is Japan treats their automobile business as a strategic asset, and they go out of their way to make sure that their companies have as many advantages in the global environment as possible, to the extent that they manipulate the yen constantly to benefit their industries.
Well, yeah, they've been keeping it very low for the last two decades, almost to the level of creating a nationwide recession in order to keep their industrial infrastructure strong.
Exactly. And in the last 6 months, just the yen manipulation alone, the valuation has contributed something in the order of $4 billion to Toyota's net profit in six months.
Wow.
Whereas our government treats our core industries to a great extent as almost like they're pariahs, that, you know, yeah, we're free trade and free this and free that, but the global economy has blown right by us, and we are sort of fighting the global economy with one arm tied behind our backs. And Detroit, that has contributed significantly to Detroit's issues. That there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. You take off after Tom Friedman in some length in your book, and not just him, but I mean, you know, on page 138 and 139, you know, I have a hot tip for Mr. Friedman, and so on. What do you think are the solutions if it's not Tom Friedman's "Let's have more free trade" and you know, "Let's go green" or something?
Well, I think the solution, I mean, look, no one would argue the fact that we have to do whatever we have to do to reduce our dependence on foreign oil from hostile regimes. That's not even a question. I think, but too often, I think especially the environmentalists are too quick. I call them the finger-snapping environmentalists, where they expect to just snap your fingers and all of these things, all of these problems will be solved. It doesn't work that way. And I think Detroit has gotten a bad rap. There seems to be a formula, which Friedman especially subscribes to, that goes something like this: Toyota equals good, Detroit equals bad. Excuse me. And I think too many in the media have picked that up, and it's a constant drumbeat.
Well, I think a lot of people in the media don't realize that Toyota is fighting against improved CAFE standards just as General Motors is.
Yeah, right? And
shouldn't we see a pox on all our houses?
Yeah, that was a big surprise to Friedman and other members of the Green Posse that I refer to when they found out that, gee, you mean Toyota doesn't make all their money from the Prius, and that they actually make a full range of vehicles, including large vehicles that in most cases don't get as good fuel economy as the Detroit vehicles that they compete against.
Right.
It's like a big revelation. But the reality is, yeah, Toyota is a full-line manufacturer. They've gotten a lot of credit far beyond what they should have for their green, their Mr. Green Jeans persona, where in fact Detroit has been competitive and has done more research and made more technical inroads than Toyota has. But that's a story that doesn't get told in this day and age.
Yeah. So is the solution a combination of changing our trade policy, looking at our industrial infrastructure as a strategic asset, and controlling our currency? Or, I mean, we have about a half a minute left, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but from here?
I think, Detroit doesn't need a handout. They're building some outstanding vehicles. I think people should open their eyes to that fact. I do think it's imperative that our government tries to assist one of our core industries rather than fight them at every turn, and realize that in this global economy, we have to start looking at our assets and treat them accordingly.
Yeah, well said. Peter DeLorenzo, he's the author of The United States of Toyota, How Detroit Squandered Its Legacy and Enabled Toyota to Become America's Car Company. The website's unitedstatesoftoyota.com and autoextremist.com. Peter, thanks for dropping by today. 16 minutes past the hour.
Yes, it does.
Have you had enough
of the
the bums out. 21 minutes past the hour. Stephen Lerner on the line with us. He is the assistant to the president on North American Strategic Initiatives and director of the SEIU Private Equity Project. Excuse me, the Service Employees International Union. SEIU.org, of course, their website. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Good to talk to you today.
Yeah. All of the above. It's morning here in Portland. It's afternoon in New York City. 11:22 here on the West Coast, and I think 2:22 on the East Coast. Tell me about this Fisher Island Liberation Day and everything that's going on around it.
Well, you got to start off with that Fisher Island is an exclusive island off of Miami, which is now the richest zip code in the entire United States. And the way they've organized it is all these really, really rich millionaires and billionaires live out there, and the only way you can get out there is a ferry or a helicopter. And workers are sort of this inconvenient thing, so they're segregated on the ferry, people aren't allowed on the beach, and they have this little paradise that they don't want to be worried about the people who do the work and try to support their family taking care of them.
It seems like we're back to the Titanic, you know, with the three classes of service kind of thing. Well, actually four, because there's the workers on the Titanic as well. How do they do that? How do you have people working in your home and you know, providing services for restaurants and whatnot without providing them with housing and you know, and pretending that they're not there? It seems almost bizarre.
Well, what we can't figure out is this some kind of leftover vestige of the segregated past where you bring your servants over and want them to disappear, or is this a scary window into the future? Because what's happened, this island is just a couple minutes off of Miami. It's a short ferry ride. But they've organized the entire thing so that when the ferry goes over, the workers have to be in a separate room from the residents. If the cars have already been loaded on the ferry, the workers aren't allowed even to walk to their separate but unequal room because they might dirty the cars. And even if it's hot, if you've worked the whole day, then you're left out, you know, out in the elements, because these folks don't want to see, they don't want to touch, they don't want any impact, they don't want any contact with the people who are helping them live this lavish lifestyle. This is a place that has a job category called bird walker. I mean, it's just, it's hard. For, yeah.
Like,
I mean,
walking the parrot kind of thing?
Well, more exotic birds than that. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to imagine the level of wealth and what it means to try to make by an $8 an hour and then be told you're not even good enough to sort of sit in the same place. You got to go off and be hidden.
You know, I was speaking with a I don't want to identify these people. One of them was an elected official, shall we say, at the federal level, and the other was a movie star. And this was probably a year or so ago. And the conversation, I don't remember how it got to it, but it was about how a former occupant of the White House had standing orders that the staff of the White House was never to establish eye contact, that whenever this person came into the room, everybody had to look away, and if anybody ever did establish eye contact with this person, they were immediately fired. And then the person from Hollywood said, oh, well, that's normal operating procedures in, you know, the homes of many of the stars that I know, and named some names. And it was, you know, I'd never heard of such a thing. But apparently this is something that goes back to European royalty, that this was, you know, for 1,000 years, standard operating practices in the castles and kingdoms of Europe. You asked the question, are we going back to the past or moving forward toward the future? It does seem like our society, since we've bought into this Reagan greed is good and the billionaires, you know, this Calvinistic notion that if you're wealthy, that must be the sign of God's blessing or something, that the billionaires among us are really carving out a separate world in these United States.
That's exactly right. I mean, we've heard about gated communities increasingly. We've heard about all the ways that people try to insulate themselves from society. These folks have taken it to the ultimate extreme, you know, their private fantasy island. But the exciting thing and the good thing is that people are standing up and, you know, black workers, Haitian workers, Latino workers, new immigrants are saying, this isn't tolerable. We're not going to tolerate this. And one of the really fun things that happened is, by technicality, the beach has to be public because it's publicly owned, even though it's a private island, but you can't get there. So there was this wonderful event a couple weeks ago, we call it the Liberation of the Beach, where people went out on boats and then they swam to the island. And it was really, in a way, staking claim to saying, you can't privatize the beach, you can't buy everything in America, and people are going to stand up and they're going to say, we're going to fight for our jobs at work, we're going to fight so we're not segregated on the boat, and we're going to fight to be able to be on the beach and be treated like everybody else.
Yeah, it does seem like we're moving in that direction, though, of a less equal America, dramatically less equal America, as you know, Reaganism, as trickle-down economics has such a foothold. And you guys at the SEIU are doing a great job of taking it on. Stephen Lerner, the assistant to the president of the SEIU on North American Strategic Initiatives, director of the SEIU Private Equity Project, SEIU.org, of course, the website. Stephen, thanks for sharing the story with us.
Thank you.
A shocker. Thanks. You're good. 27 minutes past the hour. Coming up December 6th, I'll be at the Willamette Store at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, 900 State Street, Willamette University, 2 p.m. for a discussion and book signing. And on December 14th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 7 p.m. at the University of Minnesota Bookstore, Kauffman Memorial Union. So be sure and drop by and say hi. Strange stuff in the world. Speaking of getting everybody to vote, new tactic in Thailand. Yeah, and Thai politics is kind of a long tradition of buying votes and whatnot, but somebody's come up with a brand new tactic. Instead of passing out cash, according to San Napcha, a campaigner for the People's Power Party in Pathum Thai province, just north of Bangkok, one of the candidates is now passing out Viagras. Said Sian, the politician is giving out Viagra to gain popularity and votes. I think this is a bad way of vote buying. Yeah, I agree with that. 1-866-303-227. By the way, Larry Johnson, blogging over at his new blog, noquarterusa.net. He says, now we know, get ready for some right-wing blowback, is the headline. He says, now we know why some of the Bush administration, Dick Cheney's folks in particular, fought like hell to keep the national intelligence estimate on Iran's nuclear program under wraps. Why? Because it says they stopped their nuclear program in 2003. And they say this with high confidence. So in other words, the best, strongest opinion of the entire intelligence apparatus, all the intelligence agencies of the United States, all together saying, starting in 2003, the Iranians shut down their nuclear weapons program. Yes, they're trying to start up the nuclear reactors that we helped them build under the Shah, and ones that have been built since then with the help of the Russians. They want to have nuclear fuel. They realize that their supply of oil is going to, at some point, run out. But nuclear weapons? No. 866-303-2270, Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Forgive me before I say this. I've talked about the Thai voting system.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about the outcome of the erections.
Okay.
Anyway.
If I had a drum, I'd roll it.
I have a red alert today. In 2 days here in Colorado is a deadline for registering voting or for declaring your party affiliation. And I want to emphasize, party affiliation is just as important as anything else. And this deadline may be happening all around the country. So if you're planning on voting in January, if you're not registered or if you've not declared your party, you better do it right now.
Do you have closed primaries in Colorado? Only?
No, we have caucuses. And that's one thing I want to talk about, because caucuses, I think, are much more important than primaries. And when you had an earlier caller here in Colorado in particular talk about caucuses, well, I'm, as we speak, in the process of creating a new website as a caucus guide.
Oh,
that'll
great.
Be up in the next few weeks.
Great.
Because
send me,
yeah, people
send me a
just
note
don't,
and I'll announce it.
Yeah, people just don't know about what to do on this. And one thing about a caucus, oftentimes you have a precinct, say, of 300, 500 voters, and only maybe 3 to 8 people show up. So your vote is about 100 times more powerful in a caucus than any other time. It is critically important. Also, at caucuses, you bring in the party platform. That's where you begin to decide what the platform is. You also move on to other events, and you can become a party officer. You can become, you know, a precinct captain. You can become, you know, the treasurer of the party, et cetera, on and on, by going through the caucuses. The caucus is the biggest door into power there is.
Into participation in the political, within a political party.
Yeah, but you have just over 48 hours right now.
In Colorado.
At least in Colorado.
And in a lot of other states, too. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a red alert. And what I'd like to do is call in all Libertarians, Green Party people, and particularly, excuse me, Independents. Because you can register with a particular, you know, a Democrat, the Democratic Party or the Republican Party now, and go back to the Greens or whoever for the general election. And so you can help decide if Ron Paul or Dennis Kucinich or anything like that are going to have more influence.
Right.
So you can come in and decide on the candidate. I mean, it's not just the November election. You get to decide on who are going to be the candidates. Correct. And if you're in one of those other parties, you are not deciding right now. So you can do it as a temporary thing. Come in as be a Democrat for a month and, you know, decide.
And then go back and be a Green.
Yeah, become a progressive.
Or continue to participate in the Democratic. You vote any way you want. But, in other words, get involved. Because I think it's important that people also support the Green parties at the local level, because the Green parties are the ones who are bringing about instant runoff voting all over the country.
Exactly. And actually, if you looked at the official Colorado Party platform for the Democrats, and you look at the Green Party platform, you would hardly see any difference. They're almost the same.
That's great. A real testimonial to the participation of progressives.
If I may mention one more thing.
Sure.
I'm not going to go into detail right now, but I just spent most of the weekend working on voting, and much of that is about mail-in ballots. And I must say, Tom, you know, most of the election activists are not in favor of mail-in ballots, and we're fighting it. We're going to be fighting it tooth and nail here in the next few months in Colorado. For many reasons. One of the key ones is centralization. That any problems with mail-in ballots are magnified.
Yeah.
Because if you have one problem, and that's one of the reasons why Colorado and Denver last time, over 20,000 people apparently did not get to vote because of centralized problems.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Jeff, thanks for the heads up. I've had my concerns about them, but it seems to be working just fine here in Oregon. But that doesn't mean that it's the very best system.
I'll send you some bullet points on that.
Okay, great. Thanks. Good to hear from you, Jeff. I appreciate it. Ken in New York. Hey, Ken.
Hey, Tom. I want to talk about the National Initiative for Democracy, which I think is at the core of what we're talking about in terms of getting more people to vote and in terms of giving us a direct voice in our government. Okay.
Is that Mike Gravel's thing?
It's more than Mike Gravel. It's Mike Gravel and hundreds of thousands of people that have already signed up for it. But yes, he initiated it. And it is a ballot. It's essentially a ballot initiative like we have here in New York, for instance. We were unhappy with the 9/11 commission reports. Now we have a ballot initiative to reopen the investigation with a panel here in New York City. You have the same thing in Oregon. It would be just that on a national level.
Yeah.
So if we're dramatically unhappy with legislation or performance or anything of that nature, it's a constitutional amendment.
No, I know. I understand, Ken. I got to tell you, here in Oregon and in California as well, and a couple of states that have ballot initiatives, some of the most destructive laws that are in place were put into place by right-wing cranks getting things on ballots. And then basically fooling the people with large amounts of money, much of it from out of state, about what those things should be. I just like Jeff was cautioning me about mail-in ballots, I've got to caution you about ballot initiatives. There's a reason why we have a representative democracy, why we want people to actually spend the time to carefully think through issues, to read the legislation carefully, to debate it for days, to hold hearings for weeks necessarily, and actually have, I'm reluctant to use the word, but professional politicians, that is people who are actually, for a living, taking the time to make sure that the laws are right, because I'm telling you, the most destructive laws that are in place in the state of Oregon right now were put into place by ballot initiatives by right wingers getting them on. So I'm not, you know, I respect your enthusiasm for it, but I'm just not with you on it. But you know, thanks for calling in. In any case, Ed in Hillsboro. Speaking of Oregon, in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. Listen, just following up on the tie thing again, and again, just to segue, I apologize, but I wonder if they're expecting their voter turnouts to be rising over there.
Oh, in Thailand. Yeah. Okay, another bad pun.
Yeah, yeah. I was actually calling because I had a frame for the trade issue, and actually a pair of them. In terms of talking about protecting your core industries, we need to start talking about it in terms of being smart trade, because the opposite of smart is stupid. Obviously, nobody wants stupid trade. And
that's a great frame, because we what we have right now is stupid trade, and it's not free for anybody except the transnational corporations.
Right. And in terms of taking the wind out of the sails of the free trade meme, what we need to do is start talking about it in terms of being trade rape.
Hmm. Yeah. Although I doubt that that's going to fly, but interesting point. Thanks, Ed. Mike in Seattle. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick comment I had on the Detroit auto manufacturing issue. I definitely put most of the blame squarely on Detroit's lack of leadership. I think those guys, instead of focus on the bread and butter like some of the Japanese automakers did, which is the four-door family sedan, they focused on big trucks forever and ever.
Yeah. Well, in part, and in part also, you know, just all the little things, all the little details that make a car a better car or not, you know, that, that you notice as a consumer. But I got to tell you, in Japan, there's the Ministry of Industry and Trade, MITI. There's an entire organization, actually, it's arguably one of the most powerful agencies within the federal government in Japan, MITI is. And they work to keep their industries in Japan. They work to build their industries outside of the country in ways that will bring profits back into Japan. They work to improve products. I mean, it's a massive subsidy program in a way that's not arguably or legally not a subsidy program. And the part of the consequence of that is you know, very, very well done products. So
yeah.
I'm not willing to say it's entirely Detroit's problem. It's the fact that we have, and thanks for the call, Mike, we have no industrial policy in the United States. We used to have industrial policy under the Roosevelt administration, under the Truman administration, under the Eisenhower administration, under the Kennedy, Nixon, or under the Kennedy administration. We had national industrial policies. And at, largely ever since the Reagan administration, we haven't. We haven't really taken this stuff seriously. And all around the world, other countries are, and they're eating our lunch.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're dealing in dreams here. The dream of democracy once again in the United States of America. As those who would dismantle it fade into the sunset. But let's not fool ourselves. They're not going to go easily. They're not going to go without a fight. We have to get involved. Scott in Chicago. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Right. I have a question. He has a couple parts in it, if you could address them for me.
Sure.
The overall question is if you could enlighten us on the Presidential Election Reform Act initiative that's pending in California, what's going on with that? And can you give any historical context with regard to how similar doctrines are in place in Nebraska and Maine? Also...
Now, hang on just a second. Are you talking about the one that would apportion electoral votes to districts, to electoral regions or to congressional districts based on how that congressional district went rather than the entire state?
Correct.
They call it the California Counts Act is what the Republicans are calling this thing.
They've got a lot of different names for it. Also, yeah. Do you think that there's any sound basis for defeating this measure based on Article 2 of the Constitution?
I think there is.
Which clearly states that a state's electoral votes must be appointed in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct.
Right.
And clearly, if this insidious Republic attempt at rigging the 2008 election is not preempted effectively, all other issues and considerations which we all hold so dear will have eroded forever to neocon fascism.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And interestingly, it was the Independent in the UK, the newspaper in the UK, that did the best reporting on this. Most newspapers in the United States have not even touched it. I was in California the last 4 days, and I think it was Friday morning, it might have been Saturday morning, the L.A. Times, there was an article that suggested that they don't yet have enough signatures and that they're working like crazy through the weekend to try and get them, you know, blah de blah de blah, kind of downplaying the whole thing and saying, well, we really don't think this thing's going to be on the ballot. I beg to differ. These guys have a lot of money. They've got a lot of commitment. They got a lot of energy. And this is the kind of story that they would tell to keep there from being good reporting on it, to keep there from, to prevent it from being stopped before it gets on the ballot. Once it gets on the ballot, it sounds seductive. It sounds really cool. Hey, now every candidate is going to have to come to California to campaign, whereas before they just used us as used California as their as the ATM, you know, the political ATM. And I think a lot of Californians will think this is just a great idea, not realizing that what it's going to mean is that no Democrat is going to get elected president for probably another 30 or 40 years until or unless the same kind of thing is done in several of the states like Texas that consist of large states that consistently go Republican. And, yeah, it's just it'll be an absolute and utter disaster. And at the Electoral College level, you could have somebody win by 10 million votes, a Democrat, win the popular vote and still lose the electoral vote if this thing passes, which is why Rudy Giuliani's people were pushing this thing in the beginning. Now they've taken on a lower profile, and you've got other Republican shills out there pushing it. I think it's going to be there. I think that I think it's probably going to pass. This is just, you know, I'm looking in a crystal ball and looking at the worst possible scenario, and I suspect that it'll end up before the Supreme Court, and that if in the and I think that there's a very good chance that the election of 2008 will go in such a way that the Democrat will win the popular vote and will lose the Electoral College if it's counted, if California is split in half and half of its electoral votes go to the Republican, and would win if California was a winner-take-all state, and it'll go to the Supreme Court to decide whether or not it's consistent or inconsistent with the Constitution. I agree with you. It is completely unconstitutional, but you've got this, you've got, you know, these four partisans at least on the Supreme Court who consistently, I mean, you know, look at in the 2000 election, the state of Florida, the Florida Supreme Court said, count every vote. And the U.S., the federal Supreme Court intervened and said, no, if you count every vote, it may harm the complainant, the guy who brought the lawsuit, George W. Bush, it may harm him. And so you can't count every vote in Florida. And it turned out a year and a half later when the New York Times and the media consortium actually did count every vote, that by any measure, you know, hanging chads, dimpled chads, pregnant chads, pimple chads, whatever, intent of vote, non-intent of voter, overvotes, undervotes, by any measure, Al Gore got more votes in Florida than George W. Bush did. But, you know, they've rewritten history for all practical purposes. I mean, that appeared in the 17th paragraph of the article in the New York Times because it was just after 9/11, and they didn't want to hurt George Bush right after 9/11. But we've had an illegitimate president for 8 years, and I think that they're setting up another one. And it's entirely conceivable that this election in 2008 could go to the Supreme Court. All the more reason that a lot of us have to get out there and get active and be so involved that the Supreme Court wouldn't dare do this. I mean, this could be like the next Dred Scott. You know, Dred Scott, when the Supreme Court said, no, slaves don't have any rights at all, and I think it was 1896, it produced an explosion. I mean, you know, it's just, or was it 1840? I'd have to go back and look. Wasn't it? Yeah, Dred Scott, 18. Anyhow, I'm mixing up my years, but this could be another Dred Scott kind of decision. So, your thoughts, Scott?
Well, you know, again, I'm kind of fixating on Article 2 of the Constitution, which, I mean, the language seems very plain to me, that it has to go through the legislative branch, and clearly you can't have a popular initiative thrust an issue like this onto the ballot. Is where do you draw the line, Tom? Is this where you do you try and defeat this measure before it can even be put on the ballot? Has there been an? I'm having a difficult time finding the information.
You try to defeat
it
before it's put on the ballot. You try to defeat it before it's put on the ballot, and challenge it every which way. But you know that's something that's going to be done by the wonks. You know, Dred Scott, by the way, 1856, the Dred Scott case. And B, you know, if it gets on the ballot, you fight it as hard as you can, Scott. And from all over the country, people need to be, you know, getting involved with California politics, of all things, to fight this. But, yes, we've talked about this before. We'll continue to talk about it. Coming up tomorrow, David Martosko is going to come on and tell us you don't have anything to worry about with the Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, H.R. 1955. We'll see. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag You're it. Talk with you tomorrow. Stick around for the...
This is the Tom Hartman Program.